Ground Control to Major Tom. Ground Control to Major Tom. Take your protein pills. Put your helmet on. Ground Control to Major Tom. Commencing countdown. Engines on. Check ignition. And may God's love be with you.
Lift off.
This is Ground Control to Major Tom. You've really made the grade. And the papers want to know whose shirts you wear. Now it's time to leave the capsule, if you dare.
Coming to you from the space station aboard the severed celestial head called Nowhere, this is the 10th Long Box Graveyard Podcast. My name is Paul O'Connor. Thank you for joining me today. Whether this is your first podcast or your 10th with Long Box Graveyard, I'm always glad to have you in my audience. For the next half hour or so, I'm going to get you caught up on what's happening at my Long Box Graveyard comic book blog and also bring you this month's feature, which is Marvel Comics: A Space Odyssey. Got a lot to do on the show this week, so let's get right to the news. Here's what's happened at Long Box Graveyard over the last 30 days or so since last we spoke. Of course, you can find my blog at www.longboxgraveyard.com. Every Wednesday, of course, brings a new post at Long Box Graveyard on the 13th of February. I ran a post called By Any Other Name, Darkseid. And that kind of blows the gag. Really, it was a poll to say, how do you say the name of this character, the seminal villain that Jack Kirby created for the New Gods? Is it Darkseid? Darkseid? Well, my poll ran 80-20 in favor of Darkseid, and I think that's an artifact of people coming to comics in an age of animation, where there were television shows that you could turn on and see how to see and understand how to speak this character's name. Fans that came to comics at an earlier age maybe were not so certain of how to speak that character's name. Anyway, it was a silly little poll. It ended up being an extraordinarily successful post, probably the single most successful post I've ever had at Long Box Graveyard, strangely enough. You can still jump on and vote in the poll. 13th of February, By Any Other Name, Darkseid. On the 20th of February, I ran an article on Fire and Ice, the 1980s animated feature from Ralph Bakshi and the immortal Frank Frazetta. It's not much of a picture, but it has some startling images, and anytime you get to see Mr. Frazetta's art move around, that's pretty special. So we talked about it on the 20th, Fire and Ice. On the 27th of February was The Last Days of Superman. This was like an English paper. Compare and contrast. It's been years since I wrote one of those. But this was about how two different comic book authors both addressed the story of the end of Superman. I looked at Whatever Happened to the Man of Tomorrow by Alan Moore, which were the mid-80s books that he wrote that closed out the first or the Silver Age run of Superman comics and Action Comics. I also looked at All-Star Superman, the limited series from Grant Morrison, which also looked at the death of Superman. Put those two together, two talented writers, one immortal character, and they're both trying to do the same thing. Which was better? How do they approach it? It's all there at The Last Days of Superman on the 27th of February at longboxgraveyard.com. On the 6th of March, I did a post about Red Sonja, the Marvel Comics series from the 1970s, a spinoff from Conan the Barbarian. Sonja, of course, has gone on to have a much longer and arguably more successful run at Dynamite Comics in a more modern incarnation, but at Long Box Graveyard, of course, I'm stuck in 1978, so I looked at the original, and it wasn't that great. But, you know, they're not all home runs, and there were still some things about the series that are worth remembering and looking at and analyzing, so go take a look at my blog from the 6th of March if you want to know more about Red Sonja. And also on that day, over at StashMyComics.com, I took a look at Conan the Barbarian number 24, which was the Song of Red Sonja, probably the seminal Red Sonja story from the 70s. And it's interesting kind of to compare those two and see the promise of the character in that particular issue of Conan and then wonder what went so very wrong in Sonja's solo series at Marvel a little bit later that year, or later that in that same era. So on the 6th of March, Red Sonja. at longboxgraveyard.com. Remember, you can find all those entries at www.longboxgraveyard.com. All right, well, that's looking into the past. Let's look into the future. In this case, the far future of Marvel Comics' science fiction superhero line, a loosely connected group of comics from the 1970s. The end of this month, March 2013, we'll see the debut of a new Guardians of the Galaxy comic series from Marvel. So this seems as good a chance as any to talk a bit about Marvel science fiction comic series, particularly those from the 1970s. And again, I'm talking about their science fiction superhero series, not necessarily any of the pure science fiction comic strips that they experimented with in that time. These are somewhat overlooked books in the Marvel line, and not without reason. Curiously, their greatest strength is also their weakness. I've been writing a lot about these series at Longbox Graveyard. Last month, I wrote about the origins of Star-Lord in Marvel Preview. I also spotlighted the terrific little space opera from Chris Claremont, John Byrne, and Terry Austin featuring Star-Lord from Marvel Preview number 11 in my monthly Dollar Box column at StashMyComics.com. At the end of March, I have a review coming up at Longbox Graveyard about the Guardians of the Galaxy, too. But not this new team. No, I'm looking at the 1969 Guardians of the Galaxy team, as introduced by Arnold Drake and Gene Colan in the pages of Marvel Superheroes number 18, who then went on to guest star in several comics written by Steve Gerber in the pages of Marvel 2-in-1 and Defenders, before landing in their own rather uninspired solo series in the pages of Marvel Presents, also written by Steve Gerber. And also, of course, I've written at length about other cosmic Marvel heroes like Warlock and Captain Marvel, both the Jim Starlin version of that character and the original Mar-Vell in his dorky green and white fin-headed uniform, as we saw him in the 60s and into the 70s. Wrap up with these some of Marvel's other science fiction characters, like the Jack Kirby creations or co-creations like Galactus, the Silver Surfer, the Inhumans, the Skrulls, the Kree, and the Marvel Universe. The actual universe part of it starts to become a very crowded place. And that's even without mentioning Jim Starlin's Thanos, the villainous foil of Starlin's classic Captain Marvel and Warlock runs, who's gone on to become perhaps the preeminent villain of the Marvel Universe, taking on every superhero under the many suns in books like The Infinity Gauntlet, and even appearing at the end credits in the most successful superhero movie of all time, The Avengers, with more appearances seemingly on the way in Marvel's movies. Most improbable of all, the Guardians of the Galaxy themselves are getting a movie in 2014. Now, think on that for a second. Warner's is having a hard time greenlighting a Justice League movie, and Marvel is putting their bench warmers on the screen. And if these Guardians aren't quite my Guardians, the 1969 version, they do at least boast a few characters I recognize, like my old pal Star-Lord, and guys like Drax the Destroyer and Gamora, the most dangerous woman in the universe. Characters tightly bound up with the aforementioned Thanos and those 70s Marvel science fiction books I so esteem. So suddenly all things science fictional are hot, 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 at least in Marvel Comics land, but it wasn't always so. Come with me back to the outer space era of the 1970s, and I'll tell you the way the future was. Longtime listeners of my podcast, or readers of my Longbox Graveyard blog, may note that I am fond of saying the golden age of everything is 12, as in 12 years old, which I was in the time-lost year of 1974, when I first got into comics and ruined my life for all time. I bought a lot of comics that summer, and I still have all of them, even the books I carved up for Marvel value stamps. And one of the things I liked best about that era, and why I think I imprinted on it as much as I did, is that it was an era when pretty much anything goes. Roy Thomas was Marvel's editor-in-chief, and while he kept the top-selling books like Spider-Man and Fantastic Four and Conan on a pretty short leash, the inventory titles on the fringes of the line received less attention and oversight. It was also an era where books were chronically late, and certain savvy freelancers, who shall remain nameless, wishing for their books to receive the fewest possible changes, took to turning in their work at the last possible minute to ensure as much of their original vision as possible would go to press. And so we had this crazy era where some really unusual and even daring comics were published, whether it was Don McGregor and P. Craig Russell doing their weird Killraven War of the Worlds story in Amazing Adventures, or Rich Buckler having his tortured cyborg killing machine Deathlok trying to take his own life with a laser pistol pointed at his throat, even pulling the trigger and having the laser malfunction. These were daring books, and if there had been a steadier hand on the tiller, we probably never would have seen them. I liked Deathlok at the time, less so Killraven, but these are books I would come to better appreciate as I got older. They were part of my accumulation in those days. But the science fiction heroes that really got my attention were Captain Marvel and Warlock, particularly in their classic runs by writer-artist Jim Starlin. Jim Starlin was just 24 years old when he came aboard Captain Marvel in issue number 25 of that title, but I think we can conclude it was an old 24. Starlin was a Vietnam vet, and he'd had a look at war as a photographer in an intelligence unit, and much of Starlin's work would be about war and peace and love and death. Starlin was only on Captain Marvel for 10 issues, but that was enough time to overturn the Marvel Universe. And to be fair, he borrowed many elements from Jack Kirby's New Gods, but this series still sees Starlin lay down the modern Marvel cosmology with his Oedipal struggle between Thanos and his father, and Thanos' love affair with death personified. They're cosmic stories, but they're still superhero stories at heart. You know, even Starlin's later work, like The Infinity Gauntlet, is just a big wrestling book with huge stakes. But these were and still are mind-expanding books, made memorable by the moment that Captain Marvel gains cosmic awareness and becomes an avatar for peace in the internal struggle between good and evil. It's good stuff. I think it's bettered by Starlin's Warlock run, starting in Strange Tales number 178 to 181, and continuing in Warlock number 9 through 15. This is a very good story about the Church of Universal Truth and its crusade against the unbelievers. The cool thing, of course, is the Church of Universal Truth is led by the Magus, who is Warlock's future self. This is a more psychedelic story than his Captain Marvel work. And it's superior, I think, if only for the greater degree of difficulty, as we'll see. It has a lot to do with how little it had to do with the Marvel Universe. It also fleshed out a tremendous supporting cast, including Filthy Pip the Troll, who's a great character, and Gamora, the aforementioned most dangerous woman in the universe, who now features in the new Guardians of the Galaxy team. And speaking of those star-lost Marvel heroes, I mostly want to talk about them this podcast. The original Guardians had first appeared in 1969 in a fast-paced little one-and-done issue of Marvel Superheroes, issue number 18, which told the tale of four freedom fighters in Earth's far future battling for the faith of a planet under occupation by the baleful Badoon, these evil reptile conquerors from the stars. These characters might have been lost to the ages if Marvel creators Tony Isabella and Steve Gerber hadn't gotten to talking about bringing them back somehow. And in 1974, in the pages of Marvel 2-in-1, issues number 4 and 5, Gerber did exactly that. Penning a bizarre tale in the pages of Ben Grimm's Team-Up magazine, where The Thing, Captain America, and Sharon Carter, of all people, were transported to the future to fight alongside the Guardians against the Badoon. This is where I first encountered the Guardians, and I liked them. They were third-rate heroes, but I was new to comics, and I didn't care. The original Guardians were Martin X, this kind of crystal-bodied guy who was a hybrid human raised on Pluto. It's really a shame he wasn't from Uranus, because then we could, you know, that'd be a joke that would never get old. There was Yondu, a blue-skinned noble savage with a bow. There was Charlie 27, this sort of heavy-boned, squat, Jovian militia man, who's just sort of a big tough guy, kind of a distant echo of characters like The Thing and The Beast. And there was also my favorite guy in the group, Major Vance Astro. Now, Astro, he blew my mind as a 12-year-old. Mostly because of his origin story, which saw him blasting off of the stars in the 1980s after sacrificing his humanity to make a generations-long trek through outer space. His body was preserved in a kind of foil candy wrapper, meaning he might live an extraordinarily long time. But given relativistic time dilation and other super science stuff that I don't understand, Astro knew that by the time he arrived at his destination at Alpha Centauri, the Earth he knew and all the people from his past would be long dead. But he thought it was worth it. He carried out his mission, only to arrive at Alpha Centauri for a hero's welcome. The people of Earth are already there. They discovered faster-than-light drive. A decade after poor Astro started his journey, they had no way to recall the poor schmuck. So instead, they made a folk hero of Astro, gathered to greet the irrelevant hero like a living museum exhibit as he stepped off his rocket ship, which, of course, didn't go down too well with Major Astro. You know, it's kind of a hackneyed story. Anyone who's seen an episode of The Twilight Zone or read a Captain America comic or a Silver Surfer comic will feel like they've seen this story before. But remember, you know, I was 12. This stuff was impressive to me. Even more impressive was what the story implied about this new comics universe I had encountered, that it was more than Spider-Man swinging around the roofs of Manhattan. This is also a universe full of alien creatures and strange civilizations with backstories and future histories that mankind may or may not be doomed to live out. It was the first indication I had that the Marvel Universe wasn't a static thing, that it was moving through time, that it had dates and appointments with destiny, and this made it all seem more alive and more full of possibilities. So I stayed with the Guardians, following their adventures where they popped up and later fell in love with Starlin's Captain Marvel and Warlock, as I've already described. Had I been a DC guy, I expect I would have been following Kirby's New Gods, too, though I wouldn't really get into those books before I was an adult. And I also was generally attracted to the more cosmic and science fictional mainstream Marvel hero books, too, always enjoying it when the Avengers went into outer space or Thor spanned the dimensions to take on bad guys like Ego, the living planet, or later in the 1980s when Walt Simonson revitalized the character by teaming him with Beta Ray Bill, an alien hero from beyond the farthest star. You know, these books, they weren't always successful, or at least not successful for very long. Star-Lord was two or three times trying to get started, and he never really got in gear, at least not in the 1980s. The character's been rebooted, and he's leading the Guardians of the Galaxy into the movies next year, which is kind of crazy. The Guardian solo series from the 1970s in Marvel Presents was pretty dreadful. Those Captain Marvels and Warlocks were only interesting so long as Starlin was around. When these books were good, they were very good. But when they were mediocre, they were terrible. A Marvel superhero book of the same era usually wouldn't fall so far and so fast. Mid-list titles like Ms. Marvel or Nova or The Defenders, they might be neither very good nor very bad, but they really went off the rails so terribly as when one of these science fiction books took a turn for the worse. So, why was this? I mentioned earlier that I thought the strength and weakness of a Marvel superhero science fiction book were the same thing. Well, for a long time, I thought it was just about the characters or their context, but I think it actually comes down to world creation. I thought that these science fiction stories were entertaining only to the degree that they were tied into the Marvel Universe. At least that's what I originally thought. I thought these far-flung science fiction stories were only interesting if they also featured characters and places that we knew. That they told stories about our world, because those stories really counted. I have air quotes around really counted. But, you know, that really wasn't quite right. After all, those Warlock tales scarcely touched the rest of the Marvel Universe, but they're among the best of Marvel's cosmics. And more recently, we have scores of science fiction comics that do just fine without a comic book universe to back them up, thank you, like the excellent Saga from Image Comics, or several others you could probably name. So no, it runs deeper than that. The reason these 70s Marvel space comics were so often spectacular failures. And I didn't really start to tumble to what I think is the true reason until I looked at a couple other genre titles from Marvel last year, namely Conan and Marvel's brief run with John Carter of Mars. Both these titles had Gil Kane in common. Now, I'll admit to being a little tone-deaf to Gil Kane's virtues, but I do like his covers, and sometimes I like his action art style. Kane famously wanted to work on Conan, at least for a while, and Roy Thomas was eager to let him do it, but schedules and the usual Marvel food kept him away from that assignment, for the most part, aside from an issue here or there. In one of the Dark Horse Comics reprints of Conan, which I highly recommend, Roy Thomas notes that Kane quickly burned out on penciling Conan and actually opted off the book because he was an action pose and storytelling guy, and it was exhausting to draw all those darn backgrounds panel after panel. Now, this got me to thinking about all the things that artist has to do to create even a conventional superhero comic. They not only have to draw well, they have to tell a story in images and wring emotion out of static figures. They also have to create worlds around those characters. When your stories are set in the Marvel Universe, you have a lot to fall back on. These New York guys that were doing the comics in the 70s, they could just look out their window for inspiration. Or they could look at how Jack Kirby drew Manhattan and do that. The visual grammar of the world was well understood and required little invention. Skyscrapers, taxicabs, sidewalks full of guys in hats. When Galactus towers over that skyline, all the science fiction is embodied in the design of the character itself. The world comes for free, and the science fiction is driven home by the juxtaposition of our mundane world with this cosmic planet-eating demigod. Now, this is not the case when the action is set even on a quote-unquote familiar Marvel planet like Zen-La or the Kree homeworld. Here, everything needs to be created, which is something I took for granted until I started working with production designers in the video game business and saw how the best of them really struggled to build believable worlds from the bolts up. Architecture, cars, robots, people, roadways, animals. All these things need to be created out of whole cloth if you're doing a science fiction series. And it's not like comics creators in this or any other era got extra days on the calendar just because they were working on these kind of books. And not to pick on Gil Kane by any stretch, but he was the guy who closed the loop for me on this observation and insight, because when I reviewed his run on John Carter a couple months ago at Longbox Graveyard, it occurred to me that a big part of why that series failed, and I gave it my only failing grade so far at Longbox Graveyard, the reason it failed was because so little was done with the worlds and characters and monsters and fashions and technologies of John Carter's world. Most of the art in that series was a tangle of bodies and flailing swords, where what really needed to happen was that I had to be transported to this other world. And that world would appear really only through the pencil of someone that could do characters in action, but could also build worlds and backgrounds. And there aren't a lot of guys that can do that. In this era, off the top of my head, that's something that guys like Barry Windsor Smith did on Conan. John Buscema did it too, to a less enthusiastic extent. Jack Kirby, of course, just by rolling out of bed in the morning, did this kind of thing. Steve Ditko, when he was creating the look of other dimensions, all ropey roads and door frames and yawning gulfs, he knew how to build worlds. He created a shorthand for magic and between space spaces that artists are still mining almost half a century later. So, comics are hard, man, and science fiction comics are the hardest of all. We hear that comics have an unlimited budget, you know, compared to film, television. They can be set anywhere you can imagine with a cast of thousands, but all that still has to be imagined and drawn. Maybe the budget isn't as unlimited as we thought. I remember the first comic book penciler I worked with in my own brief career, a fellow by the name of Brian Carson. When he was illustrating one of my books, I said, "Is there anything I shouldn't do?" He said, "Yeah, a superhero team fight in a house of mirrors." You know, it's easy for me to write, but it's hard for those guys to draw, unless they're George Perez. I seem to do that in every other issue. Anyway, if you're going to do a comic book, it kind of makes sense to put Earth in the bullseye. The real world makes the fantastic stuff seem more real somehow. And this saves us the embarrassing spectacle of things like, you know, an alien asylum planet that looks exactly like Times Square, which Steve Gerber and Al Milgram foisted off on us in one of the less memorable issues of their Guardians of the Galaxy run. with this additional degree of difficulty, it's no wonder that so few of Marvel's science fiction books were successful. And, you know, in another show, it might be worth looking at why Marvel's science fiction effort was, you know, how it was different from DC's effort with books like Green Lantern, Adam Strange. But even though so many of these Marvel books were hopeless, I still had an outsized affection for them. Still do. Part of this was my love of underdogs and the obscure. After all, I'm the guy that does a blog and a podcast about 1970s superhero comics. I know all about obscure. But also it was because I think of the limitless possibilities, at least expressed, if so rarely achieved, by these kinds of books. Paradoxically, if these rootless science fiction stories didn't feel like they counted, quote-unquote, at the same time, it felt like anything could happen. Few of these characters were safe from death or at least cancellation, and the canvas of space allowed for bigger stories. Star empires at war, cosmic gods bent on universal destruction. And there was also the sense of beauty, of perspective beyond our daily lives, resonant in the best of these stories. The sense that someone like the Silver Surfer had seen the wonders of the universe, but they were all lost to him now that he was bound to the limited ugliness of Earth. These science fiction stories raised the stakes, and if they so often failed to live up to their potential, at least they were trying something new. And maybe that's what makes them memorable all these years later, while Captain America's 15th battle with Batroc Zilibera has faded from memory. In this, their greatest strength was also their greatest weakness. They were apart from the Marvel Universe. And so much could happen in these books, but in being separate from the Marvel Universe, it was just that much harder to tell good and effective comic book stories. Anyway, I hope you will make an effort to revisit, or visit for the first time, some of these science fiction superhero comics from Marvel's past. And a good place to start is the Long Box Graveyard blog. Go to www.longboxgraveyard.com and hit the checklist link at the top of the page and scan for the science fiction stuff. I'll also pull out some of these links and put them in the show notes for you. You'll find that I've written about Captain Marvel, Warlock, Star-Lord, forthcoming The Guardians of the Galaxy, The Micronauts. Well, that's a great little space opera series right there. Deathlok, Killraven. You know, check the links, check out the art, read the articles, and see if something sparks for you. For the most part, these back issues are still available very cheaply. And in the months to come, I plan to continue writing about Marvel's cosmic heroes, with additional columns about the Guardians, at the very least, and maybe even some of Marvel's comic book movie adaptations of 70s mainstays like Planet of the Apes and Logan's Run. It's a limitless universe out there, and we would do well to remember it. Maybe we can remember it together. And if nothing else, by reading these classic science fiction stories, you'll understand the roots of books that Marvel seems intent on pushing in the year ahead in the run-up to their Guardians of the Galaxy movie. I did buy Guardians of the Galaxy number 0.1 off the rack last week when I was visiting my favorite comic shop up in Burbank, California, the House of Secrets. And I think it's the first individual Marvel comic I've bought off the rack in, I want to say, 20 years. It was an impulse buy. I was up there normally get a graphic novel. And just to balance things out, I did buy a back issue of Tomb of Dracula, issue number 34. So I haven't gone completely daffy. But I bought the book, even though it was written by Brian Michael Bendis, who I think is very talented, but I'm personally ambivalent to his style. But I bought it because, hey, I just finished writing about Star-Lord, and I'm writing about the Guardians, and I knew I was going to be doing this science fiction podcast coming up, and it's a new series, and I'm kind of excited about it. And I do like the new Guardians series. I had a good time with it. It's not my Guardians, but they're fun books. So I'm looking forward. I may even try to read the Guardians when they come out later in the month. So I picked it up. It tells a revised history of Star-Lord, which is, you know, changes a few things, but that's fine. It's not that big a deal. And it's a fine story. It's decompressed in the way of modern comics that I don't like so much. It takes a long time to say relatively little. I'm a little more of a Silver and Bronze Age guy. I like my stories dense. But in any event, it's nice to see that Marvel is going back to outer space, because that's a part of the Marvel universe that is still largely unexplored. A lot of fun, a lot of stories, a lot of interesting characters out there. So go to my blog, check out the history of these old science fiction characters. You'll be well informed in the year ahead as Marvel returns to space, to the characters and worlds that they, I think, most recently featured in series like Annihilation, which was also okay. Maybe I'll talk about that sometime. Anyway, this brings me to the end of my somewhat aimless ramble about science fiction comics, which in summation, I guess I mean to say, hey, they're cool, dude. Check them out. And if you'd like me to address any of these series in greater depth here at the podcast, write in and let me know. You know, I can talk about this stuff all day long, but you already know that, and I promise the show would stick to 30 minutes or so, so let's wrap it up. Okay, the plug of the month. This month is for Chasing Amazing. www.chasingamazingblog.com. Very personal blog of a gentleman named Mark Ganacchio, who is lives in New York City, in Brooklyn, I think. And Chasing Amazing is all about his quest to own every issue of Amazing Spider-Man. And the reason I like the blog is, well, it's very well written for one thing, but it's also right in the wheelhouse for Longbox Graveyard, because it's about comics, to be sure, but it's also about what comics mean, and specifically what they mean to Mark, what they meant to him as a child, what they mean to him as an adult, and how they remain a part of his life as he's trying to track down these issues individually. And when he finally gets his hands on a cherished back issue, he'll remember what that comic meant to him when he was younger and how he lost it, or, you know, read it till it fell apart or threw it away or whatever crazy thing happened. Mark's a real interesting guy, and I'm going to try to get him on the show here next month. Actually, Mark and I have connected a couple times over Skype, and we've had some scheduling and technology problems, or I would have brought an interview to you with him by now. So we'll try to get a little more Spider-Man in your diet, and if I can get this newfangled technology figured out in the next month, I'll have an interview with Mark here next month. But in the meantime, go over and check out his blog, www.chasingamazingblog.com, and read up on what Mark feels about Spider-Man. Maybe we'll talk about it here next month. All right, so where to find me? You can find Longbox Graveyard everywhere. Go Google Longbox Graveyard, and I think you'll find pages and pages of hits by this point. The best place to find me, of course, is at my blog, which is www.longboxgraveyard.com. There's a new post there every Wednesday. You'll also find me on Facebook. You'll find me on Instagram. You'll find me on Twitter as at lboxgraveyard. You can email me at longboxgraveyard@gmail.com. You can also leave a message for me at the We Talk Comics podcast message board, although I will admit I'm not as rapid in responding to those because I don't get an automatic notification where you post when someone posts a message there. Really, the best way to reach me is email me or ping me on Twitter. And also, this month only, WonderCon. WonderCon's coming up in Anaheim, California, March 29th through 31st, 2013. I will be there all 3 days. I got a room. You're not welcome to stay in the room, but you're welcome to look me up, connect sometime during the show. I'm not putting on a panel this year, but I will be there. And any readers or listeners or fellow travelers that want to connect, go take over a bar someplace, have a few drinks, argue over the old Guardians of the Galaxy versus the new. You know, I'd love to meet you and hang out and tell some stories. So if you're going to be at WonderCon, contact me one of those ways. Email me, Twitter me, something. And if you're at the show, even if it's like a last-minute thing, I'll be checking my Twitter there to the degree that the wireless allows. So tweet at me and maybe we can meet up. And that's going to bring it to the end of another month here at Longbox Graveyard. Thanks for listening. Thanks to all my many loyal listeners and readers and for their continuing support. You're the reason I do what I do. Also want to thank Mo Christensen at the We Talk Comics Podcasting Network for his help in engineering the show and posting it on my behalf. That's a great honor to work with you guys, Mark, and everybody else at WTC. It's been a lot of fun. Thanks for enabling my voice and encouraging me to undertake this podcasting experiment. Hopefully it hasn't been an experiment in terror. I'll see you guys again in 30 days. Thanks for listening, and I will see you in the funny papers.
Control to Major Tom. Ground control to Major Tom. Take your protein pills. Put your helmet on. Ground control to Major Tom. Commencing countdown. Engines on. Check ignition. And may God's love be with you.
Lift off.
This is ground control to Major Tom. You've really made the grade. And the papers want to know whose shirts you wear. Now it's time to leave the capsule, if you dare. This is Major Tom for Ground Control. I'm stepping through the door, and I'm floating in a most peculiar way. And the stars look very different today. For here am I sitting in a tin can far above the world. Planet Earth is blue, and there's nothing I can do. I can do it.